VOA1.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs in Jerusalem are learning Hebrew and Arabic from each other, modeled on the idea of speed dating. About 20 students meet weekly to learn each other's language. They are guided by cards with simple situations written out, designed to start a conversation. Each student has a partner. When a whistle sounds every 20 minutes, the students change partners. The meetings help the Palestinians improve their Hebrew language skills required for dealing with Israeli officials, and the Jews gain a better understanding of Arabic. Most Palestinians in Jerusalem live in the city's east, an area captured by Israel in the 1967 Middle East War. Only basic Hebrew is studied in East Jerusalem schools. That makes it difficult for Palestinians to reach a very high skill level in the language. And it's the same for Israelis. If they do study Arabic, it's an Arabic you can't use, said Maya Gies. She is a Hebrew teacher and spoke of the classical and not commonly spoken version of Arabic. Gies started the project in 2019 with Sahar Mukammar, a Palestinian sports instructor and a former student of hers. She says the language exercises are a crossing of a mental border between the two peoples. She said Palestinians and Israelis taking part in the program share the same embarrassment of talking and can break the barrier of fear together. Jamila Khoury, a Palestinian, said learning Hebrew could help her and others merge well in the community and find a job opportunity in a good field. Tensions in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict sometimes end in violence. Eli Benita, a Jewish member of the group, said the language learning showed the possibilities of coexistence between Jews and Arabs in Jerusalem. I see that this is the only way to reach some kind of a peaceful routine of life here in this region we live in, he said.
Last week, Mark Zuckerberg, head of Facebook, said it would rename its business Meta Platforms Incorporated. Early users of the virtual worlds, known as the Metaverse, criticized Facebook's rebranding or using a new company name. They say Facebook did not create the Metaverse and does not have the right to take credit for the idea. Metaverse, generally, is the idea for a new internet based on virtual spaces and virtual reality products. It has become a subject of much discussion this year. Both companies and investors want to be a part of the next big thing. But users have, for years, been spending time on these fast-growing but little-known virtual worlds. Ryan Cappell is one of those users. He is an American who has held meetings in different metaverses for more than 2 years. They are essentially trying to build what many of us have been building for years, but rebrand it as their own, Cappell said. Facebook's announcement comes as the company fights criticism from lawmakers and regulators over its market power, software operation, and policing of abuses on its services. In virtual reality, users appear as a moving image or avatar. As the avatar moves around, the player meets friends and plays games. Some are based around a digital financial account called blockchain that allows users to buy and sell virtual real estate. Artur Sichoff founded a metaverse virtual world called Somnium Space in 2017. He said Zuckerberg's announcement of the rebrand felt hurried, as if the company wants to become part of the metaverse story, which, he said, is happening right now. Sichoff spends up to 5 hours a day in Somnium Space, along with 1,000 to 2,000 other daily users. Dave Carr manages communications for the organization that runs the virtual world, Decentraland. He said metaverse users may resist Facebook's move because they fear its control over content. Carr compared the virtual world, Decentraland, with Facebook's planned metaverse. He thinks that people who want to control the future of the virtual worlds they live in, move freely between them, and keep the things they make, will choose the decentralized version. He said Facebook's plan will most likely be under central control. Decentraland was founded in 2017 with about 7,000 daily users. It sees itself as a choice for people who want to move away from popular social media platforms that sell user data and control what users can see. Blockchain technology is the basis of many existing metaverse platforms. It makes central control impossible. Blockchain is also the electronic heart of cryptocurrencies. In these virtual worlds, people use cryptocurrencies to buy land and other digital objects in the form of non-fungible tokens, or NFTs. Pranksy is the name of an investor in NFTs, which are digital resources such as works of art that exist only on computers. Pranksy said that Facebook wanted to claim the name Meta as soon as possible, as more brands become interested. Pranksy first bought virtual world real estate in 2020. However, the reaction from early metaverse users was not all negative. Some said Facebook's entry could raise interest in the idea of virtual worlds generally, attracting more users and causing more virtual worlds to be created. Tristan Littlefield is the co-founder of NFT company NFT42 and has been a metaverse user since 2018. He said his first reaction to Facebook's announcement was negative because he dislikes its sale of user data. But his next thought was that having a big company like Facebook come in and spend billions of dollars could be a positive because of the new people it would bring to the space. I'm Jill Robbins.
Facebook says it is ending its facial recognition system that automatically identifies users in pictures and videos. The company's vice president of artificial intelligence, Jerome Pacenti, announced the change this week in a statement on the company's corporate website. Pacenti said the decision to end the system was part of a company-wide move to limit the use of facial recognition in our products. The facial recognition system on Facebook is to be ended in the coming weeks. The move comes as the social media service faces accusations that it failed to take action to protect users, even though its own research suggested its products can be harmful. In the past, Facebook has also faced widespread criticism for not doing enough to protect the privacy of its users. The decision also followed a company announcement that it was changing its name from Facebook to Meta. Industry experts have said the name change appeared to be an attempt to move attention away from unfavorable media attention in recent months. This change will represent one of the largest shifts in facial recognition usage in the technology's history, Pacenti said in his statement. As a result, more than a billion people's individual facial recognition templates will be removed, the statement added. Meta has said that more than a third of Facebook's daily active users have given their permission to have their faces recognized by the social network's system. That represents about 640 million people worldwide. Facebook first started offering facial recognition about 10 years ago. But over time, it has made it easier for users to opt out of the system as it faced more pressure from courts and government officials. Pacenti said the company still sees facial recognition technology as a powerful tool. But he noted that the situations where it can be helpful need to be weighed against growing concerns about this technology as a whole. He said examples of acceptable uses of the technology would be to confirm a person's identity or prevent fraudulent activities. He added that Meta will continue working on facial recognition for such uses and would seek out the opinions of outside experts before deciding on how it will use the technology in the future. Kristen Martin is a professor of technology ethics at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. She told the Associated Press that Facebook's decision to shut down the system is a good example of trying to make product decisions that are good for the user and the company. She added that the move also demonstrates the power of public and regulatory pressure, since the facial recognition system has long been the subject of strong criticism. Facial recognition technology has been used by other industries as well, such as retail businesses, security companies, and by some law enforcement agencies. But critics say such systems have a high failure rate, especially when attempting to identify members of some minority groups. Facial recognition technology has also led to major concerns over privacy and ethics issues. Several American cities have passed bans on the use of facial recognition systems. And major technology companies, including Amazon, Microsoft, IBM, and Google, have stopped selling facial recognition software to law enforcement agencies. Adam Schwartz is a lawyer for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He told the Reuters news agency that Facebook's action comes after moves by other tech companies. Still, he said, it could mark a notable moment in the national turning away from face recognition. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The American Civil War in the 1860s was fought not only on land. There was a great deal of fighting between the Union and Confederate navies. This part of the war, the Sea War, is often forgotten, but it was important. The Union victory might not have been possible without the successes of its navy. Many battles took place just off the coast of the United States. Many others took place farther away in international waters. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe talk about the naval side of the Civil War.
As soon as the war started, President Abraham Lincoln wanted to block the South's major ports. He wanted to prevent the South from shipping its agricultural products to other countries in exchange for industrial goods. Lincoln's plan was good, but it had one major weakness. The Union Navy was too small for the job. The Confederate seacoast was long. It extended from Chesapeake Bay to Mexico, a distance of 5,600 kilometers. There were not enough ships in the Union Navy to blockade all of it. Many months would pass before the Union could build up an effective naval force.
The Confederacy had no navy at the start of the Civil War. The Confederate government had little money to create one, and the South had no factories to build one. For a while, the Confederacy was able to get warships from Britain. Then the Union put diplomatic pressure on Britain to stop this support. For the most part, the Confederacy depended on privately owned ships to get goods in and out of the South. About 20 of these private ships flew the Confederate flag. Most were very successful in the beginning. The Florida, for example, captured more than 30 ships before being captured itself off the coast of Brazil in 1864. The Alabama captured more than 60 ships. It was finally sunk in a battle with the Kearsarge off the coast of France. The Shenandoah sailed in the Pacific Ocean. It captured 40 ships. After the war ended, the Shenandoah tied up in Liverpool, England.
In addition to these victories, the Confederacy claimed responsibility for several new naval technologies during the Civil War. One was the first modern submarine. This ship was 10 meters long. It sank 4 times while being tested. It was raised each time and put back into service. One night, it fired its torpedoes at a much larger Union ship and sank it. But the explosion was so great that it tore apart the submarine, and it sank too. The Confederacy also developed very effective underwater explosive devices for use in the harbors.
Even with its victories and technologies, however, the Confederacy could not stop the Union Navy. The Union Navy was bigger to begin with and grew much faster. During the first 2 years of the Civil War, the Union captured several southern ports, Fort Hatteras and Roanoke Island, North Carolina, Port Royal, South Carolina, Pensacola, Florida, and perhaps most importantly, New Orleans, Louisiana. New Orleans lay near the mouth of the Mississippi River. It was the largest city in the South. It was the largest seaport. It had become a busy industrial center, producing war equipment for Confederate forces. If the Union could capture New Orleans, it would control the Mississippi River. President Lincoln appointed Navy officer David Farragut to lead the attack on New Orleans.
To reach the city, Farragut had to sail his ships past 2 Confederate forts on the Mississippi River. He shelled the forts for 6 days and nights, but the forts were so strong that the shells caused little damage. He decided not to wait any longer. One dark night, Farragut led 17 Union warships up the river in a line. The Confederate forces heard them and began to fire. One ship was sunk. 3 others were damaged so badly that they could not continue. But 13 made it safely past the forts. When Farragut reached New Orleans, he found the city defenseless. Several thousand Confederate soldiers had fled. They knew they could not defend against the bigger Union force. Only civilians remained. Farragut captured New Orleans without a fight. The Confederate flag was lowered, and the United States flag was raised over the city.
Several weeks before Farragut captured New Orleans, a new kind of Navy battle was fought off Hampton Roads, Virginia. It was the first battle between iron ships. On the Confederate side was the Virginia. It had been built from what remained of a captured Union warship called the Merrimack. The Virginia was like no other warship ever seen in the world. It was 80 meters long. The part that showed above the waterline was built of wood 60 centimeters thick. This part was covered with sheets of iron 10 centimeters thick. 10 windows were cut into it. Behind each window was a cannon. In a battle, the windows would open, the cannons would fire, and the windows would close again. At the front was a sharp point of iron that could smash through the sides of wooden ships. The Virginia could not move fast, and it was difficult to control. It took almost 30 minutes to turn around. Still, there seemed to be no way to stop this iron monster. It already had destroyed 2 Union warships, and it was coming back for more.
The Union ship chosen to fight the Virginia was the Monitor. It, too, was covered with iron, but it was much smaller than the Virginia, and it carried only 2 cannons. These 2 cannons, however, were on a part of the ship that could turn in a complete circle. They could be aimed in any direction. The Monitor and the Virginia faced each other on the morning of March 9th, 1862. They moved in close, very close, then began to fire. A Confederate cannonball hit the iron side of the Monitor and bounced away. Union sailors cheered. The cannons of the Virginia could do no damage. But the Union sailors soon discovered that their cannons could do no damage either.
The men inside the 2 ships suffered from noise, heat, and smoke. The roar of their own cannons was extremely loud. Even louder was the crash of enemy cannonballs and explosive shells on the iron walls. Some of the men suffered burst eardrums. At least one man was struck unconscious from the force of a cannonball against the iron. The men quickly learned to stay away from the walls. Smoke from the cannons filled the ships. Then it floated out over the water. At times, the 2 ships could not see each other.
The Virginia and the Monitor fought for 3 hours. Neither ship scored an important hit. Neither suffered serious damage. Then the cannons of the Virginia fell silent. The Confederate ship had used up its gunpowder. It also had used up much of its fuel. It was lighter now and was floating higher in the water. A well-aimed cannonball could hit below its iron covering and sink it. The Confederate captain decided to withdraw. The Union captain, too, was ready to break off the battle. He decided not to follow. Neither ship could claim victory. But the Monitor had kept the Virginia from destroying more of the Union's wooden warships. The Virginia itself was to live just 2 more months. Union forces seized the Confederate Navy base at Norfolk, where the Virginia was kept, and the Iron Monster was sunk to keep it from falling into Union hands.
The battle at Hampton Roads between the Virginia and the Monitor was undecisive. It did not have much effect on the final result of America's Civil War. But it was still an important battle, for it marked the beginning of the end of the world's wooden navies.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.